This is At Your Service, a series of GARs, the Georgia Radio Reading Service, highlighting programs and services intended to improve your quality of life. This program is sponsored by the John and Mary Franklin Foundation. I'm your host, Ken Traina, and joining us for this episode of At Your Service is Marilyn Self. She's the Manager for Disaster Readiness with the Metropolitan Atlanta Chapter of the American Red Cross. Ms. Self, we want to thank you so much for joining us today. Briefly, can you give us a description of what is the American Red Cross?
Well, the Red Cross is a humanitarian organization, and our mission is that we are led by volunteers. Our mission is to provide emergency services and to help people plan for, prevent, and to respond to emergencies when they do occur. We are led by volunteers and governed by our congressional charter and the international principles of the Red Cross movement.
And when did or how did the American Red Cross come about?
Well, the American Red Cross was founded by Clara Barton in 1881 when we received our original charter. It grew out of a movement that was started in Switzerland by a Swiss citizen, Henri Dunant. And he had started the organization based upon his observations of what was going on in the Crimean War. Back during that time, there were no rules for warfare and no protections for noncombatants, no protection for people who were wounded or for people who treated them. And what he saw caused him to believe that there had to be a better way. So you've heard of the Geneva Conventions, and most people don't really know what they are, but that's what they are. It's a set of laws and rules by which countries agree to sign a treaty to establish a Red Cross organization in their country. It provides certain protections for noncombatants, for the wounded, for those treating the wounded, both on land and on ships at sea. And we have a congressional charter, which provides us with a mandate to respond to emergencies and disasters of all types. And actually, at the time we were founded, we were the only organization of any national stature that existed to provide that relief. That was before governments did that sort of thing. It was before FEMA, before public health, before the military had any of those roles. So we were the only organization responding back then.
And can you please describe some of the services that the American Red Cross provides?
Well, we provide a variety of things, and probably most people know best disaster response and blood services. And this is the headquarters for the Southern Region Blood Center, which provides blood for about 120 hospitals in the state and others throughout the region. And generally, it's about 513,000 units of blood every year, which is a lot. It's one of the larger blood centers in the country. And then we also provide emergency services, disaster response, as well as disaster preparedness. Last year in the Atlanta area, we responded to over 800 events, almost 830. So twice a day, an average of four families are assisted by the Red Cross every day here in the metro area. Most of those disasters are residential fires, and they make the news, and sometimes you'll hear a tagline that says the American Red Cross is assisting. But we have teams of volunteers who respond 24 hours a day, week in, week out, holidays not excluded, and they show up at the scene of a fire and help that family to have a place to stay that night, to have funds so that they can eat and replace their emergency needs for clothing and bedding. And then we work with them to get relocated and to reestablish their lives.
I'm sure there are some other examples of how the American Red Cross has assisted in a disaster or emergency situation.
Well, we respond to all kinds of disasters in the area, any kind of windstorm, wildfire, flooding incidents. Those are the most common. We will respond to hazardous chemical spills, to transportation incidents that affect residential areas or have a significant impact on the community, incidents of terrorism, both, you know, natural and man-made events. If it causes human suffering and displaces people from their homes, and they don't have the resources to provide for themselves, then that's an event we respond to.
And there are Red Cross units or divisions all over the state?
Yes. We have 11 chapters in the state, or 11 groupings of chapters. But every single county is covered by a Red Cross chapter. And then there are about 700 chapters throughout the country. all of them who respond the same way to the same kinds of incidents in their local communities. Most of the disasters are small. They're local events. Your local volunteers respond to it. They go to the scene of the incident. They provide all the services that are needed. They assess the damage. They feed people. They provide the casework, and they do everything that's needed right on the scene of the accident or the incident in the middle of the night whenever it occurs. And then follow-up is done later from the office. But when disasters are larger and affect hundreds of people and displace a large number of people, then it may take more resources than the chapter has, or it takes more than the local response team can muster. So we go into a larger type of response where everybody kind of responds in a specified role, and you either do feeding or sheltering or health services or government liaison work or any of a number of other activities that have to be done. Most people see the people that are in the shelters or driving the feeding trucks, but supporting them are hundreds of other volunteers who are providing the administrative and logistical support that make it possible for them to be on the front lines providing direct service.
Marilyn, who contacts you when there's an emergency situation? Is it an individual? Is it a government or government agency? What?
Can come any of a number of ways. The client themselves may call us if it's a small incident and say that they've got a problem. We may hear directly from the fire department or emergency management if it's a larger event. Those are the usual ways. If it's a transportation incident, we may hear from the airline or the other carrier involved. So we'll get the message a variety of ways. Sometimes our most common way of hearing about it is through the media. We'll hear it on the television or the news and know that phone's going to be ringing soon. So,
please tell us, what was maybe the most unusual incident that you responded to?
Oh, I suppose the two that stand out the most for us, certainly 9/11. That's one of those where everybody remembers where they were and what they were doing. And you wouldn't think that Atlanta would be vastly involved in an incident that happened so far away. But we have some of the most expert volunteers in the national system of volunteers, and we knew they would be needed quickly, and they were. So we were immediately deploying people. And we actually wound up, because of a generous donation from Delta Airlines, we wound up booking the flights for every disaster responder and for most of the families trying to get to that area through Atlanta. We set up our own travel center, and we're doing that here from here. And I guess, of course, the next would have been Hurricane Katrina and the response here. We had no idea that Atlanta would be the site of so many evacuees. We wound up servicing over 43,000 families, more than 150,000 people. It was enormous, totally unplanned and unforeseen. And not until we opened the doors and the crowds were there, literally, did we realize what the impact would be here. So we wound up sheltering and providing financial assistance for 4 to 6 weeks following that event.
I understand also that the Red Cross does provide training for communities. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
We certainly do disaster preparedness training because while we are very active in response, we're trying to put ourselves out of that business. We would love to see everyone so well prepared that the need for response would be much, much less. And so last year we reached about 17,000 people with presentations on disaster preparedness, what they can do to be ready for a disaster, to help from having such a major impact on their families, and so that they're better able to meet their own needs and be self-sustaining for a period of time. We hope we never see another catastrophic event like Katrina, and certainly not here. But if there were such a major disaster, when they're that large, it takes a while for the responders to get to you, for organized relief to be available to everybody. And the best preparedness anyone can have is to have done some planning of their own, be ready, have assembled some supplies, and to have anticipated what those needs would be and be ready to take care of themselves and their own family, at least for the first few hours or days.
Now, Marilyn, what about some specific ways that you would recommend people prepare themselves?
Absolutely. The most important thing is to be informed, to know what kinds of disasters can occur. And in the Atlanta area, we know that the most common disaster, of course, is a residential fire. And that can be caused by man-made causes or accidental or thunderstorms or whatever. The second most common disaster here are thunderstorms because they cause a lot of fires and they cause a lot of wind damage and power outages and things that really affect us a great deal. Third are floods. We have a lot of rivers and waterways through areas, and oftentimes people don't know that they're in a floodplain, or, as we've been finding out later, the floods have exceeded our awareness of what floodplains were. Fourth, most likely in the Atlanta area, are hazardous material accidents, particularly related to transportation. We have a lot of railways, we have a lot of highways, and a lot of trucks carrying chemicals on them, and, of course, the busiest airport in the world. So those are kind of the things. Tornadoes are follow that, and then we're all trying to be sure that we're ready for that pandemic flu event whenever it may occur.
So what should people do? I mean, what's part of the process of being prepared as an individual
for any kind of disaster? Yeah. Well, first know what your hazards are, and then know, how do people get the warning? What's the government plan? Is it going to be announcements on television? Are they going to do sirens? Do they put police cars through the neighborhoods? Are they going to be calling you on the telephone? All of those are options, and all of those are systems that are used in the metro area in one place or another. So you need to know where you are. How will that be, that message be conveyed?
All right, and while we're on that subject, how does somebody find out how the message is conveyed?
Call your local emergency management. It's the best way to find out what it is in your particular area. And then know, how are you going to get that message? People who have a variety of disabilities may not hear the sirens or may not be able to get themselves out of harm's way. So you have to know, what would you need to do to be able to receive that message when those warnings are aired and do go off. And then know, you know, where are you going to go? What are you going to do? What do you need to do? And think that out ahead of time. Once you're kind of informed about what's going on and how the warnings are delivered, you need to know where services are going to be provided, what kinds of things are going to be available. And you need to think through, where might you be when a disaster occurs? They can occur anytime, anywhere. And you may not be with your family or your usual support systems. So probably first and foremost in most people's minds are, how do we get away from harm, and how do we get back together again? So we need to plan, you know, where, for every building and place that you're in, your own home, every room in your home, how do you get out of it if a disaster occurs? And have it, you know, if there's a fire, have two ways of getting out of every room. And that means maybe having some ladders that you can drop down from an upstairs window, because usually a window is the second option out of most rooms. And dropping to the ground is not always the best plan. So you need to think about, how would you get out of that room if you had to? And then thinking through, you know, where would your family reunite? What we have found so often, particularly with home fires, is that people are killed going back to rescue family members that they don't know have already escaped from the home. So have a meeting place out at the front mailbox, in the neighbor's driveway, by the back gate, whatever, so that you know where everybody will gather, so you'll know that everyone has gotten out of the area. And if you're separated at the time of a disaster, some people are at school, some are at work, some are in different locations, plan meeting spots. Cell phones may not work. You may not be able to reach everybody by telephone. So everybody needs to know that we're going to meet at one place in the neighborhood where you live, and one away from it, because it may be your neighborhood that's most severely impacted. You may not be able to get back to it. So oftentimes people will pick a favorite restaurant, church, library, police station, whatever, a spot that everybody knows and feels comfortable with, a friend's home, any place that you can get to and that everybody knows to gather.
Can you tell us, how big is the Metropolitan Atlanta Area Red Cross, and what does that encompass exactly?
It depends on who you're asking. Okay. For the Red Cross, our chapter covers 13 counties, and that's Cobb and Douglas counties, Paulding and Cherokee, Gwinnett, DeKalb, Rockdale and Newton, Clayton, Fayette, Henry, and Butts. The Atlanta Regional Commission defines the area a little bit differently, and, you know, every agency has its own. But those are the 13 counties this chapter covers. That's about half the population of the state.
So what do the volunteers go through to be able to respond?
Well, one of the things a lot of people don't realize is that we do have employees at the Red Cross. This chapter has a fairly large number for a Red Cross chapter, but we only have about 50. And only 11 of those are dedicated to emergency services. Some of them work in other areas. Of course, when there's a really big disaster, everybody pulls together. But the main part of the work is done by our volunteer teams. And we do have about 1,300 volunteers who are trained and skilled and able to respond to disasters of a variety of sizes. Everybody goes through a basic orientation to disasters and what they occur, and there's some foundational courses that all responders take. But then depending on what area they want to work in, they specialize in certain things. We have about 300 or 400 volunteers who are on our disaster action teams. Those are the ones who respond to the fires day in and day out and to the local emergencies and are usually our first responders on the scene. And they have training in disaster assessment and in how to set up a shelter, how to provide feeding services, and most of all, how to do casework and provide financial assistance, and also how to do some emotional support for people that at the scene of an incident. But then when we get into the larger responses, people kind of specialize in the roles that they're in. So we have people, we have nurses and other healthcare professionals who take health services training on top of some of the basic courses. Other volunteers specialize in the casework area. Some specialize in the background areas like logistics, and they'll work in warehousing or procurement or transportation assistance or some of those areas. Some specialize in staffing. Some do the feeding activities or the sheltering activities. So some do the help us to do the collaboration with other organizations and the liaison work, either with government agencies or community organizations. Some work in public affairs, some in fundraising. So there are an awful lot of areas that people can work in. Some of the roles are administrative and in the background, providing support to the responders. Some are on the front lines, actually doing the initial work. But every single one of them is vital to making the whole operation work. And without them, you don't have that. Some volunteers are, you're just starting, you're typically at a beginner level. But as you get more practice and experience and training, they may move into supervisory or leadership roles. The unique thing about the Red Cross is that our volunteers carry every bit and sometimes more responsibility than the employees. They can commit every resource the organization has. They have the financial authority to spend all the dollars that need to be done based on their level of experience and knowledge. But we have management level volunteers, and I have a volunteer who is my volunteer partner. And he is really responsible for ensuring that the chapter is maintained in a state of readiness. He answers to the chairman of the board, another volunteer, who answers to the board of governors to be sure that the Atlanta chapter is ready. The employees answer up another line, but we each have our volunteer counterpart who really carries a lot of the responsibility and makes the same decisions and helps to manage the overall operation of the chapter.
Marilyn, about how many people comprise the Metro Atlanta chapter?
We have about 50 employees and 1,300 volunteers.
I know that here at GARS we rely on many talented volunteers. If anybody's interested in participating in any way, shape, or form as a volunteer for the Red Cross or a trained responder, what works to make that happen?
Yeah, we're working really hard at expanding our volunteer corps. We need many more people to be part of our disaster action teams, to be sure that we have responders who live in every part of the community. Right now, a large number of our responders live in far away from where most of the incidents occur. And we really want our whole volunteer corps to come from as close to where the events are as possible, because it's their neighborhood and their neighbors, and they relate to each other better. And that makes it much better. So we're recruiting very stringently right now for people who can respond, particularly from inside the city of Atlanta and in some of our outlying counties where we have fewer volunteers. But all they have to do, we'll always need more volunteers in every area, but we're specifically short of people right now willing to work in the logistics areas, some of those background things. We desperately need more health services volunteers and mental health. Those are kept the key areas, but there's not an area that we couldn't use more help. And all they have to do is call the local chapter or go to the website and sign up to volunteer there, fill out an application, and within a month we'll have them plugged in and into training and ready to go.
Okay, and can you tell us about the emergency drills and exercises you perform and how people might participate in that as well?
We do a variety of training activities. There are certain set courses that we do, and then we develop local workshops. But the best learning tool of all is to be actually be able to practice it. So at least once a year, we do a really large shelter exercise, and we task certain volunteers to play roles they haven't done before. And put them in a new experience and a new setting, even if it's being a supervisor instead of working at the line level. And that usually involves a couple of hundred people at a time. We can sometimes manage more than that. Some volunteers play the role of clients, and they simulate various scenarios and things that might happen to challenge the players to think through some of the issues. We have key areas we want to be sure that we test, that everybody knows how to do. And for the last several years, we have been inviting participants who have a variety of disabilities and who can help us to think through how can we best make the appropriate accommodations to make them comfortable and functional in a shelter setting. And it's been very helpful to us and very insightful to get those observations and to be able to get some firsthand experience at thinking through some of those issues. It was really helpful last fall when we had the floods, and we had to deal with some of those issues and thinking ahead of time about what do we need to do to be better prepared to provide support.
Over the years, are you finding that as individuals we are better prepared than we used to be?
No, I'm afraid not. We're not better prepared. People still are in the denial stages of it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen here. It's not going to be that bad. If it does happen, you know, there's nothing I can do about it. And of course, you know, none of that is true. There have been several surveys that show that a very small percentage of families actually have a disaster preparedness plan, have put together a disaster preparedness kit. Now, probably most of us have the majority of things that you would need in a kit in your home. But when you think about the fact that a tornado gives you about an 8-minute warning at best, that's not enough time to run around the house and find the flashlights and the batteries and the copies of your important documents and throw together some canned goods and where's the can opener and, you know, whatever else you need to put in there and find your medicines. And we've got the things, but they're scattered all over our house. So we need to take the time to assemble them and think it through, particularly if you take medications and you have some medical conditions and physical challenges so that you have extra supplies available and they're in a kit ready to pick up and go. If you have a fire, you have 4 minutes to get out. Too late to be putting stuff together.
And what do you think it's going to take to get people to the level of preparedness that you'd like to see?
Well, I think a lot of times it's looking at believing that something really can happen and that if it happens, you can be better prepared and you can take care of yourself and your others by doing something ahead of time and being prepared for it. What's that magical moment? When did most of us start using a seatbelt? Probably when we started strapping our children into car seats. Or when it became law. Even that doesn't always work. But you have to hear the message over and over and over. You have to believe it's real, and you have to think you can do something about it, and that it's not prohibitively costly. And that's the good news. You can buy a disaster preparedness kit, and that's a good thing to do. It's convenient, but you've probably got most everything you need already at home. Just pull it together. Put it in an old duffel bag and stick it in the trunk of the car or in the garage somewhere handy, and it's done. But it takes a couple of hours, and it does take a little money.
Would you say the biggest hang-up is the time?
It is for most of us. But, you know, I think one of the things that I have found that a lot of people find that works is if you just make the commitment you're going to do it, and every week you'll do one thing. And in fact, we have a brochure that kind of describes how to do it that way, because it does take some time and effort. So 1 week, buy 2 bottles of water to put in your kit and make a list of your medications. The next week, assemble something else and take another preparedness step. Think about your meeting spot. Where's it going to be? And if you kind of break it down into manageable tasks, it's not so long. And before you know it, maybe at the end of 3 months, you're pretty well ready.
All right, and what about blood donations, the continued need for blood donations? You're still always in need of blood donors, is that correct?
Well, you know, as large a blood center as we have and as many units as we process every year, we are still an importing state. We do not collect enough blood in Georgia to meet our needs. It comes to us from other states. we have to collect more than 2,000 pints a day to meet the needs here in Georgia. And we do not get enough blood, particularly the type that's most often needed, type O. And so we're always looking for people who need that. And people who receive, who have to get a large number of units of blood because of chemotherapy or other treatments that they may be going under where they're going to require blood, really need to be matched up with one donor as much as possible so that they're not getting it from a variety of sources. If you get a lot of blood, you could have reactions. So and to match them as closely as possible with someone whose blood is really compatible with theirs for all the minor little trace elements. For most of us who just need a pint or two every now and then, just the basics work fine, but we're not getting a lot of blood, and that can make a difference for them. But we find that we need more donors all the time, particularly from some of the minority communities. We need a lot more African Americans to donate blood, and it does make a difference. It takes the whole community to donate, to have enough on the shelves. So we need all of us participating to make that happen, especially during holiday times and times of high usage, because those are times when donors are busy and they're least likely to come in, but that's when you have more usage of blood. Mm-hmm. So it takes all of us to take care of each of us.
All right. What is the process for giving blood?
Well, the process is very simple. It's come in, you go through a sort of a mini physical where they ask some questions about your health history. They're not trying to be nosy or to get into your private business, but we do have to be careful because there are some diseases and some things that are carried in the bloodstream, some medications that we take that would be carried in the bloodstream that would be harmful to somebody else. So we do have to ask some questions about that. So each donor is screened very carefully to be sure that their blood would be safe for use by other people. And then once you go through that, and you also want to be sure that the donor themselves are healthy and that, you know, that they're well enough to give blood, because you don't want it to have any adverse effects. And generally it doesn't. It's a very minor, it's a very simple process. You sit in a very comfortable chair and put your arm out, and somebody helps you to watch TV or read a book or do whatever. There is a needle that they use, and yes, you do get stuck, but it's not terribly painful. It lasts for a very short period of time that you feel the prick of the needle. And then you just lie there long enough for the blood to be collected into a bag, and somebody talks to you, and you can relax and read a book and whatever. We ask you to wait for a few minutes once the donation is completed to give yourself time to kind of get used to it so your brain doesn't get confused about that, you know, you've lost a little bit of blood, so you want to, your system to adjust. We'll give you something to drink and some good cookies to eat, and that takes just to give you a little time to kind of get your system back in equilibrium. Most people never notice any difference at all. You want to be sure that you've replenished that fluid volume. You actually will replace the volume of the fluid that you've donated within 24 hours, but it takes about 5 weeks to replace all the red blood cells and those things. So we ask people to wait about 5 weeks between donations, but you can safely give every 5 weeks. And if everybody would give even just twice a year, everyone who's eligible, it would make a tremendous difference and we wouldn't have a blood shortage.
All right, people, anyone and everyone who's listening, please remember to donate blood. We've been speaking with Marilyn Self, Manager for Disaster Readiness with the Metropolitan Atlanta Chapter of the American Red Cross. Marilyn, we can't thank you enough for taking time out of your day to join us today. Again, listeners, if you would like more information, please contact the Metropolitan Atlanta Chapter of the American Red Cross. Their number is 404-607-1207, or you can visit their website at www.georgiaredcross.org. Georgia is spelled out. Again, that phone number, 404-607-1207. And again, that website is www.georgiaredcross.org. Our thanks again to Marilyn Self for joining us today from the American Red Cross on this episode of At Your Service, proudly sponsored by the John and Mary Franklin Foundation. My name is Ken Traina. I'm going to remind you again to please give blood, and thank you for listening to GARS, the Georgia Radio Reading Service.